From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. It's no secret that the Trump administration is at war with higher education. Since President Trump took office, the U.S. Department of Justice has launched investigations into Harvard, Columbia, and dozens of other universities, now including two in Nevada. At the University of Nevada, Reno, federal investigators are looking into a program called UndocuPAC, which helps undocumented students enroll and connects them with financial resources. And at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the DOJ has launched a probe into pro-Palestinian protests that took place on campus in 2023 after Israel launched ground operations in Gaza responding to Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack. To better understand what's going on, I spoke with Isabella Aldrete, a reporter with the Nevada Independent, who's following the story. Isabella, thank you for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So what did the letter from the DOJ say? What federal law is the school supposedly breaking?
The letter from the Department of Justice seems to take issue with this 1996 federal law that restricts access to public resources for undocumented people. They're saying the UndocuPAC program, which helps connect students with scholarships and financial help, is in violation of that 1996 federal law. However, it's important to note that the UNR program uses no federal funding. The UndocuPAC office has only one full-time position, and that's funded through the university. So the information in the letter saying that it is using this federal funding is not entirely reflective of how the program actually operates.
Scrutiny of the UndocuPAC program comes as the Trump administration has increasingly targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in higher education. Several schools in Nevada, including UNLV and Nevada State University in Las Vegas, have restructured or entirely eliminated their DEI programs. UNR, on the other hand, has repeatedly affirmed its support for DEI practices. What's the reasoning for that?
So you're right that UNR is unique as it's one of the few schools that has stood by the DEI title. There seems to be a couple reasons for that. In a campus-wide email UNR President Brian Sandoval sent out, he seemed to suggest that maintaining an inclusive environment is key to student success and UNR's mission. He also goes on to say that, you know, a lot of the claims in the DOJ letter do not accurately reflect how the university operates. So he goes on to reiterate that no federal funding is used for the program. And he also emphasizes that all of the students at UNR have met NG enrollment guidelines, and that includes undocumented students who may qualify for in-state tuition if they meet certain criteria according to state law.
Let's switch gears and focus on the UNLV investigation. The probe focuses on the school's response to the protest that took place after October 7th, 2023, when Hamas attacked Israel, launching the ongoing Gaza war. First, remind me what happened at those protests.
So the protests at UNLV were a part of a larger series of nationwide protests against Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza. The protests at UNLV were quite a bit quieter than some of the larger protests at schools like Columbia, which included encampments and administrative occupations. At UNLV, we saw a quieter version of that. So we saw some disruptions of lectures and typical protests. Following those protests, a Jewish student filed a lawsuit alleging that the university facilitated anti-Semitism and encourage terrorism by allowing these protests to go on.
In a statement, the school stated it plans to fully cooperate with the DOJ. What does the Justice Department say it wants from UNLV officials?
The agency requested that UNLV share a description of entities responsible for responding to the October 7th attacks. It also requested a spreadsheet from UNLV listing all reports and complaints of discrimination based on religion or national origin. Importantly, the DOJ acknowledged that some of the requested info might contain student information that is protected under federal law, which I think is pretty important to highlight.
This is actually the second federal investigation into UNLV. Earlier this year, the Department of Education launched its own investigation into the school. What's happening there?
So that investigation has to do with the PhD Project, which is a nonprofit that helps students from underrepresented groups get degrees. This is part of a larger crackdown on DEI programs. And the Department of Education is suggesting that program was part of unequal DEI practices by, promoting underrepresented groups.
Have we seen anything come from that investigation at this point?
Not yet. Officials from UNLV told us as of last week that the investigation is still ongoing and nothing has been finalized, and they did not elaborate beyond that.
So what happens now if the DOJ comes to the conclusion that UNR and UNLV violated federal law? What could happen to the schools?
The main pattern across all of these investigations is the question of funding. This summer, the DOJ put out a memo saying that federal funding could be pulled from schools that are found to have certain DEI practices. And I think it's really important to note throughout this conversation that DEI is being used as a catch-all term by the Trump administration. It's not just referring to conventional DEI programs, but also gender-neutral bathrooms, race-based scholarships, things that are typically not thought of as DEI. So if these investigations don't turn out to the DOJ's satisfaction, we could see some major changes to how these schools are receiving their federal funds.
Isabella Aldrete is a reporter for the Nevada Independent. Isabella, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've clicked on the news lately, you've inevitably run into a think piece about the current state of Nevada's tourism-based economy. Through August, nearly 26 million people have visited Las Vegas this year. That's down almost 8% over the same period last year, according to the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. Some blame the prices. Visiting the Strip has gotten awfully expensive for tourists and locals alike, and some believe it's a sign of deeper economic turmoil. David Brancaccio is the host of the Marketplace Morning Report. He was recently on assignment in Las Vegas looking into that very topic, and he stopped by our studio where I asked him, how useful is it to use Las Vegas as an economic barometer for the rest of the country?
Part of me says, let's play into Las Vegas's uniqueness and essentially othering you here, saying you're so weird and it's fascinating to look at and has nothing to do with the rest of us. You could do it that way because, look, it's not like any other place in the country or the world. I'm kind of looking for commonalities. I'm looking for a way that, you know, you're a fascinating, diverse enough economy that is undergoing some pressures that other places are also feeling. So, you know, social media is full of Las Vegas is dead. There's no traffic. There's no one on the strip. That's not true. But the statistics do show a downturn. If you have the choice of whether or not to spend a few extra dollars in doing some travel and that it might involve this part of Nevada, whether you come or whether you don't come says a lot about how financially secure you feel. And it appears a lot of people are feeling less secure these days. If you're pinching pennies wherever you live in the world, you might have to reduce your discretionary travel for fun. And that's when it comes home to roost at a place like the Las Vegas region, so dependent on that kind of discretionary spending.
The narrative for a while now is that Nevada's economy has been sluggish, at least since the pandemic. This was a major talking point in the election last year. So why do you think there's so much interest in the southern Nevada economy now?
Some people think that what we're seeing now for this downturn is just a readjustment from boom times in 2023 and a bit into 2024. Seasoned observers that I've talked to think it's something more concerning than just a readjustment to the boom, that in fact they're seeing a downturn. I mean, some people just don't feel welcome coming here. We've talked to some of them. The Canadians, I mean, they're annoyed about this notion of being annexed by the United States against their many of their will. And the dynamics from Asia may be somewhat poisoned by the tough trade relationship, but a lot of it is there's the ongoing dire property market problem affecting China, where it was overbuilt and it got frothy. The government tried to rein it in, and a lot of household wealth has been lost. People taking less risk there, they have less money rattling around to come visit here. So there's that as well. And then people coming across the southern border. That's, of course, in the news a lot as well.
If you had to pick one piece of the Nevada economy that translates best to the rest of the country, what do you think it would be?
I know that over the years, I've covered stories, I'm sure you have, right? That you try to diversify the southern Nevada economy, you know, because that way, if tourism blips down for, you know, the 2008 financial crisis or a pandemic or immigration crackdown, other things can pick up the slack in the economy. Now, you do have lots of biomed. You have all these interesting other industries here, but still the hospitality is the big kahuna. So does that make you unusual or weird so that we shouldn't consider you, that it doesn't affect, it doesn't inform our understanding of the national economy? I don't think so. I was talking to a person who's full of economic data, understands this area really well, and he was pointing out that cities across the country are trying to develop their own hospitality industries. I'm from the state of Maine. They have all that summer tourism on the coast, but my little mill town in the center of Maine, nowhere near the ocean, recently did some farsighted things and redeveloped its somewhat sad Main Street downtown. They're trying to get hospitality people that nurture that hospitality industry. They have a decent hotel there. Wow. They have some museums that are world class. So if Las Vegas is the canary in the coal mine that questions over discretionary spending and people being risk averse, not sure if they'll be employed in 6 months, if that affects people in Nevada, could it affect people in Maine? So that's where I think we can almost universalize the experience here and makes it all the more interesting to see what's going on.
David Brancaccio is the host of the Marketplace Morning Report. David, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
The Las Vegas Aces are in the WNBA playoff finals for the fourth time, facing off against the formidable Phoenix Mercury. The Aces have won two of their previous championship runs, and so far this time around, they're 2-0 in the best-of-seven series. Game 3 is tonight in Phoenix. Las Vegas Review-Journal sports reporter Callie Finn will be there, as she has been all season, and she joins us now. Callie, welcome to the State of Nevada.
Good. Thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
I'm glad you're here. You know, a near record-breaking win streak qualified the Aces for the playoffs, and they've had a nail-biting wins against the Storm and Fever in rounds 1 and 2. You know, has this season been an especially exciting one to cover in the WNBA in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I mean, you said near record-breaking. It was record-breaking. They won 16 straight games to close the regular season, which is the most in the WNBA to ever end the campaign. So that was definitely something unique. And I mean, to your question, has it been especially exciting? I don't know if I would say that. I think to start, it was especially confusing because this was a team that looks on paper like one that could really be a contender and wasn't playing like one for the first half of the season. So the second half of the season definitely has been more exciting in the first half because they look like maybe what a lot of us who were watching the team closely to start expected.
You mentioned that losing record in the halfway point of the season. You know, what turned the team around?
I think it's a combination of things. They started this year with a lot of changes. So they had lost two key assistant coaches, Natalie Nakase and Tyler Marsh, to their respective separate head coaching roles in the WNBA. They also traded Kelsey Plum, honoring a request that she made. And acquired Jewel Lloyd in the process. Kelsey Plum was obviously core in the two championship runs that you mentioned to intro this little segment. And so I think they just had to really adjust. I think that some of the new players they bought in, I mean, they made lots of changes. They made mid-year trades. They, you know, acquired forward Melissa Smith, who's been really important as a starter alongside Asia Wilson. So there are so many different things to pick apart, but I think what everybody will point to is that they lost to the Minnesota Lynx by 53 points on August 2nd, and that was the worst home loss any team has taken in the WNBA since, like, the inaugural season of the league. So I think that that things were kind of starting to turn around a few games before that, and then it was like they dipped in a really terrible way by taking that kind of loss. And then they never lost again in the regular season. So on paper, that's definitely the turning point.
All right, let's talk about the finals. Tell me about the Mercury. They've been underestimated and had to fight tooth and nail to get to the finals. You know, what factors put them there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that something that stands out to me about the Mercury is that they similarly were adjusting. They had only returned two players from the previous season, which is almost unheard of. Like, just two players coming back from a previous campaign is really rare. So it's like they're starting from scratch, and they were really introducing this new big three, if you will, in Kalia Copper, Satu Sabali, and Alyssa Thomas. Alyssa Thomas was an MVP candidate, alongside, obviously, the Aces four-time MVP, Asia Wilson. But they had to really find their fit. They also dealt with a lot of injuries to start the season, which limited their new big three from playing extended minutes together. And so they really relied on newcomers and some rookies to kind of get them into the position that they're in now. And so then towards the end of the season and, you know, the playoffs that put them in the finals, you were seeing just everything kind of work together in their favor. They also have a really similar coaching, or their head coach has a similar background to the Aces head coach, Becky Hammon. Nate Tibbetts also is from the NBA. He's also, they are the two highest paid coaches in the W because of their resumes. And so I think all of that combined is what has helped put the Mercury in this position.
Aces star forward Asia Wilson said Phoenix is a tough place to play. The Aces home court Michelob Ultra Arena is notoriously packed and loud. How much of a difference will the home court advantage make in the rest of the series for both teams?
I mean, I think it could be crucial. That's something that we definitely witnessed in the previous, the second round series that the Aces just played against the Indiana Fever, which went the full distance of five games because of, you know, a key road loss that the Aces took in Indiana. And I think that the crowd, it makes a huge difference. Also, just the travel, the lack of familiarity, there are all these things that change when you're on the road. And, I mean, to be fair, the Phoenix Mercury have a really, really passionate fan base. Like, they're affectionately called the X Factor in Phoenix. I don't even know that the Ace fans have a name like that. So I think that's a little bit of a nerve-wracking signal that the Aces will need to be prepared for. But at practice yesterday, the Aces played with music blasting. It seemed like they were kind of
Callie,
trying to prepare.
And Callie, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Callie Finn is a sports reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Callie, thank you so much. It's official. The A's stadium is under construction. Now it needs a casino, right? Enter Bally's, the gaming company, not the property now known as the Horseshoe. You know, last week they released artwork and plans for a 26-acre mixed-use development to be built at the southeast corner of Tropicana and Las Vegas Boulevard. It surrounds the proposed stadium. The development plan emphasizes entertainment, dining, retail, and especially in a front-facing plaza designed to welcome those going to the stadium and the casino. It's an ambitious plan for a company that's never built anything for the Strip before and has been in the news lately for its issues with building casinos elsewhere. Recently, Nevada Public Radio's Mike Privat spoke to Mick Akers, sports business and transportation reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, about the development.
Mick, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being part of this. So construction for the A's stadium is already underway. How much does that affect the plans for the proposed casino hotel entertainment center?
No issues on that. Obviously, the A's have the 2028 deadline to have their stadium ready. So they wanted to get that work underway pretty quickly, which they started some of the groundwork in April, started going vertical last month. And now you're starting to see a lot of the development around there coming up over the 10-foot construction wall. You know, the A's and Bally's have been in contact, you know, ever since they announced their initial land deal, you know, a few years ago. So all along, they knew that the A's were going to get in there first. But Bally's has been saying, hey, we want to get some portion of our project, you know, underway and open along with the ballpark itself. So, you know, they have been having conversations over the years about, you know, how this would play out. And I think it's kind of come to life now.
When might the first phase be open?
First phase is the plan is to have it open in 2028 along with the ballpark. So that's going to be that 9 acres of shared space. It's going to be the 3,000 space parking garage and then a utility area. We're going to have all the utilities for the ballpark and Bally's grand plan once it's all said and done.
I did see that parking garage in the rendering, the 3,000 space garage in the southeast corner. You know, there's a lot of talk about how people will get to and park at the new stadium. I'm wondering how much total parking will be available on site.
You'll see that parking garage with the 3,000 spaces in the rendering. What you don't see is underground parking, which will be located just underneath the sports bar you see on the corner there. So it's going to be about 2,000 spaces underneath there. Then you got 40 some odd thousand spaces within walking distance with all the MGM properties around the ballpark. The Boring Company also has plans to have a Vegas Loop station there. You got the RTC bus. I'm sure they're in talks, maybe getting a Game Day Express going like they do with the Knights and the Raiders.
Now, as for getting to and from A's Stadium, the sentiment locally, as you probably know, is that Tropicana Las Vegas Boulevard intersection will be even more terrible to navigate once the A's begin playing there. And, you know, we're talking potentially thousands more cars during that key primetime hour period. And, you know, never mind what it could look like on days where multiple arenas and stadiums have events at the same time. I'm wondering, have there been discussions yet on future traffic around and near that site?
Yeah, so, you know, there's always traffic studies that go on when you have a large scale project like this. They've looked at that, and obviously it's one of the most busy, you know, intersections in the world there. There will be some upgrades on Reno behind there and Giles, so that's going to make it a little more accessible and make the traffic free flowing on that area. It's kind of a wonky intersection at this point, so they're going to make it more of a streamlined intersection and have that main entrance into the ballpark located off Reno there, just on the south end of the ballpark site. That's going to be on the way here, you know, sometime in the next couple of years once the ballpark's kind of taken shape.
Mick, you were talking about possible changes in the area, like or where the Giles Reno intersection is. I'm wondering, does that fall at all on Bally's or A's?
That's going to be part of the $25 million that Clark County has promised the A's for the ballpark as part of Senate Bill 1. So, you know, anything that goes over $25 million in infrastructure upgrades around the site, which includes roads, the A's will be having to foot the bill on that. I don't think it's going to surpass that with that. It's just minor road work to get that intersection, you know, upgraded and ready to go for large scale events. Just getting that Giles Reno intersection upgraded is going to be a big plus for the local fan. I think that's the way most locals are probably going to be trying to enter the ballpark, either if they're coming from Tropicana and they can head down that way from there, or if they're heading from Las Vegas Boulevard north towards the Strip, they can get on Reno and Giles at that point.
You also recently reported on permitting for the stadium project. Where are they in the permit process, and how is that affecting the progress of construction?
Yeah, so the permit process is going along as they plan. As part of their entitlement process, they had Clark County come into an agreement saying they would approve a number of permits so they can get the construction going before their development agreement was approved. Right now, they have about $900 million worth of permitting in with Clark County, with about $137 million of that approved.
Mick Akers is a reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal who covers sports business and transportation. Mick, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here to talk more about Bally's is David McKee, editor-in-chief of Casino Life and contributor to several gaming media outlets. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So Bally's is the owner of the casino operations. This is for the entire complex that will surround the forthcoming stadium. David, I wonder if you could give us a brief background on the company. Who is Bally's and how prevalent is it in the casino industry?
It's a company that has a dozen and a half casinos in the United States. It was originally Twin River, and they have, under the oversight of majority owner Soo Kim, they've scraped together a flotilla of casinos from Nevada to New Jersey, mostly second and third tier properties, most of them in second and third tier markets. And they're trying to make the leap up to the first rank.
Bally's bought the buildings and began leasing the Tropicana from Gaming and Leisure Properties in 2022. Outside of that, had they ever had any properties or dealings in Nevada?
They have a casino in the Lake Tahoe market, but they have never operated in Las Vegas.
You describe Bally's as a ramshackle empire in a July Casino Report story. What is so ramshackle about them?
They occasionally are described as a national builder of casinos. They have never built a casino. This company has been scraped together from various odds and ends of casino properties. They have ambitions, possibly pretensions, possibly even delusions of operating on the biggest stages of all, but their experience is relatively shallow.
Now, this is a very ambitious project for Bally's. They're also busy trying to finish a downtown Chicago property, a controversial development per your reporting and, you know, a lot of other journalists. And it is tied to the health of the Bally's finances. Where is that project right now? And what is the state of the Bally's large debt load?
Well, that's two good questions. The project in Chicago started going vertical this week. At this point, we have to introduce the silent partner in this, Gaming and Leisure Properties Incorporated, which is a real estate investment trust, which basically bailed out Bally's when the project ran out of money, or more technically, when Bally's exhausted its borrowing capacity. GLPI has taken over construction of the project. They are not only putting up most of the money, they also have one of their executives in charge of construction. So for all intents and purposes, it has ceased to be a Bally's production until the doors open sometime in late 2026, at which point Bally's steps forward again as casino operator. Now, Bally's is carrying at this point $5.6 billion in debt. That is way more than its cash flow has been able to sustain to make the financiers happy. So Bally's is doing a number of things to try and get itself a little more elbow room. And they basically sold everything that isn't nailed down at this point because they are trying to reduce their debt load, which fortunately for them doesn't come due until 2028, and to get a little extra borrowing capacity to fund their ongoing obligations.
Now, how could all that affect the building of the Las Vegas property?
Well, that is the multi-billion dollar question, because without money, they can't build it. The interesting thing about the recent spate of stories about the Bally's project last week was that nobody posed this question to Bally's. How do you intend to pay for it? As we mentioned, the Chicago project ran afoul of limits on what Bally's could borrow, which was basically not very much. Now they have to put forward a multi-billion dollar obligation in Las Vegas. There is no budget for this project. No firm details have been released. Everything is very vague. They had been operating on the assumption that GLPI, since it had paid for the demolition of the Tropicana and a few other things, would step in and rescue them again. GLPI is evincing increasing reluctance to do so. In the most recent earnings call, the CEO of GLPI, Peter Carlino, said that he didn't know how much more money GLPI was going to put forward to that project, if any. That is not the first time that they've indicated a lessening commitment to the Bally's project. So if Bally's goes forward with this, and they have a few years left to realize it, they're going to have to find their money somewhere else. Real estate investment trusts like GLPI are not in the business of building things. Their intention is to buy real estate that exists and is in good shape, and then act as a landlord. So they haven't really sounded too thrilled about being in the driver's seat in Chicago, and they haven't stepped forward to finance the Las Vegas project. They haven't stepped forward to finance the New York project, and they haven't put a penny towards Bally's adventures in Australia. It's not what they do.
So, David, I do detect a tone of skepticism in your voice. I am wondering, is there a very real possibility that Bally's falls off this project?
I think so. They are well behind where they need to be to meet their self-imposed deadline of being open when the ballpark opens. That stadium has been in construction for close to half a year now. Bally's has a rendering and a vague 2026 commitment to start construction and be open within 2 years. Now, in Las Vegas, mega resorts don't get built in 2 years. It takes 3-4 years. Unless Bally's taps into a mother load of financing, this project is very unlikely to happen.
Now, when you say that, is there a possibility that another company could come forward to work with GLPI and finish the job so there is, in fact, all this proposed infrastructure around the stadium?
I think there's an excellent prospect of that. GLPI works with credible casino operators with long track records like Penn Entertainment. still talking about a huge parcel of land that's going to go for a hefty price tag if GOPI ever decides to put it back on the market. And they would be in the catbird seat as far as attracting someone else to take that over from a tenant who didn't pan out, potentially.
David McKee is the editor and chief of Casino Life. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And earlier, I spoke to Mick Akers, reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, who covers transportation and sports business.
We're back with KNPR's State of Nevada. I'm Paul Boger. Nevada was among the first states to ratify the 19th Amendment in 1920. Roughly 100 years later, we elected the first female majority legislature. Between the two, Nevada saw many other milestones in the women's political movement, as UNLV political science professor Rebecca Gill tells Nevada Public Radio's Heidi Kaiser. But first, Heidi talks with Shayna Taub, creator of SUFS, which opened this week at the Smith Center in Las Vegas. Taub was the first woman in history to win Tony Awards for Best Book and Best Score in the same season.
Shayna, welcome.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
I'd love it if you could take me back to the moment you decided to begin writing and composing SUFS. What was happening in your world, and what effect was that having on you and the women you love?
Yeah, I was 25 and I was looking for a full-length evening topic, you know, to write a whole musical about. And I knew I really wanted to write a story of a group of young women working together to take on a system. And I was looking for things to adapt. And at the time, I was taking the Robin Hood myth and kind of gender flipping it. And then my friend Rachel Sussman, who ultimately was one of our lead producers on Broadway of SUFS, asked me to go to coffee, and she asked what I knew about the American women's suffrage movement. And I sort of realized with some horror that I didn't really know anything. Like, I grew up going through public schools and I didn't know the story. I'd only maybe heard the name Susan B. Anthony. I knew her face was on money, but I didn't know much more. And she gave me a book about the Silent Sentinel pickets outside the White House in 1917 and how American women pioneered so many forms of protest in this country and were jailed for it for long sentences and went on hunger strikes and were force-fed in this incredibly dynamic story of an American social movement of my female ancestors that had never made it to me till I was 25. And I was like, this is the story I've been searching for, and it's been right in my own backyard, and it didn't make it to me. So who is it making it to? So I really want to just set out to write the show that my 14-year-old self would have been hungry for.
Yeah, and let's bring that forward to today. What do you see happening now that makes the musical relevant?
My goodness, where to start? I mean, it's always holding both truths in your hand that we've come a long way. Like, my life as a woman in America is materially better than it would have been 100 years ago. I enjoy more rights and privileges. And yet, of course, we're seeing so many rollbacks to women's rights, especially in the arena of reproductive freedom. You know, I'm 36 and I grew up taking Roe v. Wade for granted. And it was overturned when we were doing stuff off Broadway at the Public Theater. And to think that healthcare that women and girls need, that I'm, you know, lucky to live in a state like New York State where I have it, and it, should I need it, it's not a guaranteed right anymore. And that feels extremely frightening.
It's been 105 years since the 19th Amendment was ratified, giving women the right to vote. And one of your songs, you write, "You won't live to see the future you fight for, but keep marching on.
You won't live to see the future that you fight for. Maybe no one gets to reach that perfect day if the work is never over."
The battle for the women's vote took 150 years. More than a century later today, what rights are your audiences, or maybe even you, marching for now that may not come for a long while into the future?
I may not, as I was speaking before, I may not live to see Roe reinstated and, you know, by the Supreme Court. I may not live to see women and girls get equal pay in the workplace. I may not live to see the immigrant rights that I want to see respected in this country, climate legislation. I mean, the list goes on and on. Racial justice, there's so many fronts that we're fighting on. It can be overwhelming. But I think part of the work of activism that I think the SUFs had to come to learn, that I try to take in my own life, is just because we can't get everything done in our lifetime doesn't mean we're let off the hook from trying. You know, even as you were saying, it took 150 years. Even the 19th Amendment, as we know, and as we address in the show, it was not a complete victory. It took many more years for women of color to get the right to vote in many, many states. And of course, we still see voter suppression in many marginalized communities today. And yet we can't let that discourage us. We've got to push it forward in our lifetime as much as we can.
The play's main characters are fictionalized versions of famous historical figures in the women's suffrage movement. Alice Paul, who you played, Ida B. Wells, Carrie Chapman Catt. You adapted their real stories to your narrative. What was the research process like for you and the other actors getting to know these iconic women?
Absolutely. I dove into research and became a little obsessed with it, especially in the first chunk of years of the decade-long process of writing the show, because it was just such a thrill of discovery of these women that I never heard about. And there's just so, it just felt like this treasure trove of American history. And then for me, the process as a dramatist, I had to come to realize I wasn't writing a history book. I wasn't creating a museum exhibit. I wasn't building a statue. It was my job to make a piece of human drama that humanized these women, not glorify or vilify them, but find that human element in between. And, you know, the lifeblood of a play or a musical is what's going on inside someone's mind, what's their inner life, what's their emotional life. And not all of these women left a lot behind in that area. And I sort of had to, I mean, some of them did, but not all of them. I had to sort of make my peace with the fact that there was no such thing as, quote, getting them right. And I had to allow myself to invent them and imagine them and see my friends and my mentors and the women in my life that I recognized in these women and have to just bring them alive for a new generation.
I was thinking as I was listening to some of the music from the show that the message we demand to be heard must really resonate with Nevadans who elected the first female majority legislature in the country. Shaina, what do you hope for staging the musical here? What do you hope that Nevadans can take from that in what one could argue is a contemporary model of women's political power?
Absolutely. That's amazing. And I'm so excited we're going to be showing up in a state that's making that kind of history. I mean, Nevada was one of the, as I'm sure you know, and some listeners may know, was one of the early states to give women the right to vote. The western part of the country was ahead of the curve, and a lot of women were enfranchised in western states, Wyoming, Nevada, Utah, Montana. And so I think Nevada was a pioneering suffrage state. And so it's exciting to get to bring the story back to a place that was ahead of the curve, but way ahead of New York, way ahead of a lot of the eastern states where we've performed the show so far.
Shaina Taub wrote the book, Lyrics and Music for Suffs. Shaina, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. I hope audiences in Las Vegas enjoy the show. Thank you.
I want to turn now to Rebecca Gill. Rebecca is an associate professor of political science at UNLV. Rebecca, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So Shaina Taub was talking there about Nevada being one of the early states to ratify the 19th Amendment. That was in February of 1920, of course. And then in 2019, Nevada had the country's first female majority state legislature. In those intervening 100 years, what were a few of the other remarkable milestones in women's political progress?
Well, in Nevada, we had some women who were involved in governing before even Nevada allowed women to vote. So we had this very interesting trajectory. You can imagine in the early days of Nevada, there weren't that many people here. And for how many things there were that needed to get done, a lot of times women were stepping into the breach, right? And so fairly early on, we had some experiments with some legislation that would allow women to serve as trustees in boards of education, on and off sometimes with superintendents and things like this. And, you know, they had this movement that was paralleling the national movement for suffrage, but it dates back well before they were able to get suffrage for women in Nevada and then a couple of years later in the rest of the United States. In that intervening time, we did actually have women start to serve in the state legislature. And over time, after the 19th Amendment, slowly we started to see more and more women participating in that way and in other elected offices.
On the flip side of that, what have been some notable setbacks?
This is a really interesting question. A lot of these setbacks parallel some of the setbacks that we see elsewhere in the country. But I think the notable story coming out of Nevada is the persistence and the slow but steady growth of the representation of women in public life, in particular in these elected positions. As you noted, we were the first state to have a majority woman legislature. We also, before that, we had a majority woman state Supreme Court. And our judges are elected. So we see this willingness in Nevada developing to see women as appropriate candidates for these kinds of positions.
The musical Suffs focuses on some iconic national leaders in the women's suffrage movement. Tell me about a couple significant Nevadans in this battle.
There were quite a few, actually. But one I think is particularly interesting is a woman called Anne Martin. And she graduated from the University of Nevada, Reno, and then went to Stanford and started the history department at UNR after that. And she took some time after that and went to England and participated in their suffrage movement. So when she came back to Nevada, she was pretty raring to go. So she, you know, immediately took what she had learned from that process and started to join the other people here in Nevada who were already starting to kind of reinvigorate the movement, the activism, the organizing that was necessary to get things over that last stage.
Rebecca Gill is an associate professor of political science at UNLV. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Let's start things off with books, or rather the notion of fewer books. This week is Banned Books Week, and Clark County Library has an event addressing this form of censorship. Tell me about it.
This is a very timely event, and not just because it's Banned Books Week, but given all the talk about the First Amendment of late, the edicts against diversity, equity, inclusion programs, and the increasing battles with schools and school boards. So the backstory here is that local theater company Asylum Theater wanted to address all of that. So it's staging a reading event at the Clark County Library Main Theater. The program, it's called Free to Read, Free to Be the Dream, and it will feature several actors and readers taking famously banned books and reading portions aloud. Announced readings include Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl, and Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And this event starts at 2 p.m. on Saturday, October 11th, and it is free.
Sounds like a celebration of the First Amendment, if you ask me. And from there, not one, but two celebrations of Asian culture in Southern Nevada.
And they're on the same day, Saturday. You can divide your time between the two if you are game to do that, and maybe you should. The first one is from the city of Henderson. They have been hosting the Aki Matsuri Japanese Festival for years. In fact, this year is its Sweet 16. And it's great because of the sheer amount of offerings that it has. You can watch musical performances and traditional odori Japanese dancing. In fact, I believe attendees can participate in the latter. There's a sake pavilion where you can attend a seminar or just go and drink sake. There's a slew of food vendors, including local Japanese dining mainstays Raku and Ichiza, as well as merchandise vendors selling all kinds of goods. There's crafts and other kind of things for kids as well. With so much on offer, this event starts at 11 a.m. and goes till 9 p.m. That's at the Water Street Plaza, and that is also free. Now, over on the other side of town at the College of Southern Nevada Charleston, their annual Asian Night Market has been rebranded as the Asian Lantern Festival. And it mainly differs from the Aki Matsuri Japanese Festival in that it represents the entire Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander community. The Lantern Festival will also have performances. I really want to stress the food. I watched a preview video and I suddenly got very hungry by the end of it. So don't bother with dinner before this one. It takes place from 5 to 11 p.m. Tickets are $5.25 a pop. There is a $105 VIP option, and that one has exclusive food options.
Not going to lie, Mike, you're making me jealous talking about all this food. There's a lot of festivals in Southern Nevada this weekend, but you have another one to recommend. Is that right?
Yes. And by the way, don't forget about the ginormous Age of Chivalry Renaissance Festival. Pride Las Vegas is also happening this weekend. I believe Reno has a ukulele festival and its long-running Great Italian Festival as well. I want to highlight a downtown Las Vegas music festival, though. I went to the inaugural edition last year. I had a fantastic time, and it's called Best Friends Forever. It's an event that centers on the post-punk, post-hardcore rock music of the 1990s and early 2000s, much of it falling under the tag of what we call first wave emo. Now, you can imagine this event being overrun by Generations X and Y, but a masterstroke of this festival is the booking of younger, newer bands who were very clearly influenced by the veterans on the main stage. And if you want a local connection, if you still haven't been convinced, singer-songwriter Jenny Lewis, who grew up here in Las Vegas, will be playing with her recently reunited band, Rilo Kiley. That is October 10th through the 12th, starting at 12:30 each day. And tickets vary depending on what festival pass you're looking for.
It all sounds very exciting. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.